Hello and welcome to the first live in-person recording for the Locust Podcast. I'm here with the guests of honor, the author guests of honor, for this year's International Conference in the Fantastic and the Arts, Terry Bisson and Connie Willis. Welcome to you both.
Hi.
Hello.
And I thought that perhaps we could start talking a little bit about short stories and creating short stories versus perhaps creating novels. Terry, did you want to start?
Well, I would say that I mostly do short stories. I do a few novels. I think I got into the business actually backward from the traditional previous way of science fiction writers, in that I wrote a novel before I ever did any short stories. So I sort of
backwards. Yeah.
That's totally backwards. So and then I never wrote a short story until I'd already published a novel. And Ellen Day, I think my first novel I did for Hartwell, like everybody else, and it, I think I got $1,500. And then Ellen Datlow, who I'd come to know a little bit through science fiction, said she was doing Omni at the time, and she asked me to do a short story, and I wasn't particularly interested. And then she said they pay $1,800 for a short story.
Wow.
So I thought that sounded like a good plan.
Yeah.
So that's how I got into it.
Yeah. Well, I came in the traditional way, which was to write lots and lots of short stories, and in fact didn't write my first novel, Lincoln's Dreams, I didn't write until after I was well established as a short story writer. So, and although I write novels now, the short story is like my favorite. I think it's the heart of the field, and I continue to write short stories. I mean, and I think that they're, to me, they're perfectly geared towards what science fiction does. Because if you are writing a novel, you have a whole world that you have to deal with. And you have the problem of the world that has to be solved and the problem of the characters that has to be solved. But in a short story, you can kind of give just sort of a little keyhole glimpse into a future or a keyhole glimpse into another reality or something. And you're not responsible for all that background stuff. And you can just kind of dive in and do something really cool. And you can also do a story that is not meant to be a realistic future, but simply what I guess I'd call a symbolic future. I mean, something like Harrison Bergeron by Kurt Vonnegut, where nobody really expects that future to exist, but symbolically it's a really interesting kind of story. That's the one where people are made exactly equal. So if they're particular, the ballerina has to wear weights and the smart person has to wear the helmet with the interrupting signals. And it's not meant, nobody, including Vonnegut, ever thought that that was going to be a viable future. But you don't have to have a viable future. You can just have sort of like a thought experiment in a short story, which you can't really do. Thought experiments that go the entire length of a novel, I don't think hardly ever work. So
no, not thought experience. It's true. But I remember that Vonnegut story because I was a huge Vonnegut fan. There was a time in which I thought Mother Night was the early novel of all time. And I remember coming across that. Harrison
Bergeron.
I remember the story very well because the politics of the story just stirred me a whole lot.
Oh, yes.
It was an attack on the whole concept of affirmative action.
Right.
It was published in the National Review.
Right.
Really?
Which clearly thought that they had an anti-affirmative action story.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I remember I hated this story.
Yeah.
And,
it is one that seems so anti-Vonnegut, you know, other things he wrote,
yeah.
you know.
Yeah.
But it's really very thought-provoking. It makes you think a lot about sort of opportunity of, you know, of giving people a start versus the opportunity of outcome, you know, and then just to me, all the messes that you can get into when you're trying to make things even, you know.
Right.
So
to me, it was the opposite of thought-provoking because it was in National Review. I determined not to think about it.
Exactly. You knew what they thought they had.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. Well, it'd be interesting to know what Vonnegut thought he had, so.
How much do you guys pay, you know, when you're writing or, well, I guess after you're writing, how much do you pay attention to the market that you're marketing to? Talking about the different venues and...
I never think about it. There aren't that many markets. It's not like there's this huge panoply of places. and for me, I write you know, I feel like I write for 5 or 6 different places, and they're not that different, so
right.
I don't think about that, you know.
Yeah, and when I first started, you know, everybody said, make sure you read the market you're sending to, make sure it's adapted to the market. I never was able to figure out what the market was. I mean, I never was able to figure out what is an FNSF story, and how is it different from an Omni story, and how is that different from Asimov story. And so that didn't make a lot of sense to me. It did make sense in terms of, you know, don't write, your chances of selling a 5,000 word short story, a 2,500 word short story, are better than of selling a 40,000 word novella when you're just starting out. That I knew, and that influenced me a couple of times. But other than that, I have always thought that writing for the market is usually just, in many ways, a waste of time, because you're always like 6 months behind of, you know, and I hear people saying, well, you know, zombies are hot right now, and so I'm going to write my zombie novel. And you're like, but by the time you finish your zombie novel, they'll no longer be hot. So your trick is to either A, figure out what the next trends are, which I don't see how anybody can do that, or B, just write the stories that appeal to you, and yeah, presumably they'll appeal to somebody else.
That's the way I feel. It's like, but in a sense, you're always writing for the market, because you're writing because there is a market there, and you kind of know what
right.
it is. And so it's not, you know, you read the how-to, the Writer's Digest and stuff, and they
right.
say all this kind of stuff that you do. But in fact, it's what every writer's already done.
Right.
You know, Larry McMurtry once said, you don't write, you write what you read. You know,
absolutely.
And so I think everybody writes for the market in a way, and in another sense they don't. So it's
right.
It doesn't really compute. You know, it doesn't
right.
really matter that way. But I would always think, especially back in the 90s, when the short story market was a little more viable, you know, and
right.
I wouldn't write for the market. Well, occasionally I did, but I would always think, all right, Alice Turner, then Ellen
right,
Bentlow.
Right, exactly.
And then, you know, you go down the scale
right,
of what
right.
you're going to get for it.
Right,
you know?
Yes.
And that's,
aim for the best pay first, right?
Yeah, and that's, but that's
right.
not so complicated.
Did you sell to Playboy? Did you ever sell
Well,
to
that's
Playboy?
When I thought about writing for the market. There were stories I would have written anyway, but, you know, if they have a little
yeah.
sex and lingerie.
Right,
and,
exactly.
And stuff like that.
Exactly.
Although,
I never cracked Playboy. I've always felt bad because that was a market I really wanted to get into.
Well, I got lucky that way.
So.
I remember selling my first Playboy. And a Playboy story was worth $6,000.
Oh, I know. I mean, it was amazing.
I mean, huge amounts of money. And Alice Turner bought my first Playboy story. And we're still good friends. You know. And then I wrote 5 or 6 after that. I actually, you know, did a lot of Playboy stuff because I, and they're romantic comedies. They're not like Playboy was kind of funny because it's much reviled as just the pinups and stuff, but they actually were a quality short story market with a certain
right.
amount
they
of
were,
prestige.
And that joke about I only read it for the articles, you know, that was a joke. It's true. That's not why people bought the magazine.
No.
But there were really great articles in it, and there were
yeah.
really good short stories, and it was something that people could read that had nothing to do with the pictures. And
yeah, and the interviews were good, too.
Yeah, and the interviews were fabulous. So.
And Alice had a... who did she inherit it from? I forgot. It may have been Ben Bova that was doing it.
I think that's right.
Yeah.
I think you're right.
Yeah, but you know they would do Updike. They do Joyce Carol Oates. They
right.
would do quality stuff, and so it was an enormous thrill to
right.
be in there. You know,
and then it was a huge drop down to the next one, which was
more.
Omni, because they just didn't pay nearly as much. They were the best paying true science fiction market.
Right,
but they still. They were way below.
Yeah, way below that.
Know,
so,
way below the Playboy. So.
Yeah, I remember going out to, I think it must have been about 92 or 93, and I was, Judy, my wife and I were living in East Tennessee, taking care of her parents. We were down there for 2 years dealing with these old mountain people, putting them in a home where they didn't want to be, and it was dreadful. And I wrote this story, and sent it to Alice, who I'd met a time or two, and she liked my work, and so she was receptive to it and everything. And And then we were back in New York doing something, and she took me and her minions. She'd always have, just like Charles liked to have pretty right. girls around, you know. Right. Alice had three or four boys that were her minions, you know. And we all went out to this fancy lunch on 55th Street, and they told me what they wanted, like, liked about the story. All of them, not just Alice. And this part was, basically, they thought it was really good, maybe a little of this, a little of that. And we went to this elaborate lunch, and finally at the end I said, are you guys buying the story or not? I mean, what's going on
right,
here?
Right.
And Al said, we're buying the story. And I thought, wow.
Well, it could have been a much more fun lunch if they told you up front, right?
Right, it would have helped. Although it was fun anyway. Yeah. But no, that was a great market. Yeah. But that's gone. Playboy, right. They still do quality stuff, but it tends to be reprints and big names
right.
and stuff
right.
like
exactly.
that, you know, and not much science fiction was a little unusual. She'd do Silverberg and Joe Haldeman,
right.
and I was lucky enough I was a little goose compared to them, but I was lucky enough to get into that thing.
Well, I think it's absolutely true that you write what you read, and I know that, you know, people always ask me about my influences, and for a long time I used to say Heinlein was the main one, because, of course, the Heinlein juveniles were the first things I read. But really, real early on, after reading Heinlein and then a few other science fiction authors, I stumbled on our library's collection of the year's best fantasy or science fiction, you know, the Robert P. Mills stuff, the Anthony Boucher stuff, the Judith Merrill collections. And those, I think, formed my idea of how to write science fiction far more than Heinlein. I loved Heinlein's light, breezy, conversational style, you know, and his things were always like, you didn't have trouble reading Heinlein because you started out in somebody's kitchen, you know, or somebody's living room, and it was all very, it wasn't alien and strange, and you didn't have to absorb this much when you started. It would be a kitchen, maybe with a robot, or a kitchen with technological appliances or something, but it was familiar enough that you could find your way and then move into the science fiction. But I was also reading all those great collections, and I was reading Theodore Sturgeon stories and Clifford Simic stories and Fritz Leiber and Kit Reed and Shirley Jackson and just all these fabulous things. And it was like they were using this incredible variety of styles and stuff, because to me, the short story is where all the experimentation has always been in science fiction. And so I was getting all kinds of signals of what I could get away with and what kinds of stories I could tell, and that I would say probably influenced me more than anything else. No particular writer, just sort of all of them together, you know.
Huh.
So. Well, and the nice thing about those collections is you're getting the cream of the crop.
That
Some
was it.
Editor is
it was
going
pre-edited
through.
For me. It wasn't even right. like reading the pulps, which I never read. I did not know they existed. To me, science fiction was what appeared in that year's best, and so they were already culling all the great stuff and putting it right there for me to read. And then just getting so many great writers side by side. I, of course, got a much higher impression of science fiction than I probably should have. I had no idea how much junk was out there. But that was probably good. And so, yeah, it was a great way to learn how to write science fiction, I think.
Well, it's funny. With me, I think I probably came into it 10 years earlier than that, because I started reading it in 56, 57, and I was reading the pulps, although I never thought of them as pulps. It was like If and Astounding,
right.
and they looked kind of classy.
John Campbell.
And I lived in a little town. There wasn't a bookstore, you know, but those things would appear on a newsstand in a drugstore or something like that. But I didn't read them. I didn't want to be a writer. I never thought of that. I read them just because they were not kids' literature, which I never liked. I read the Oz books, and that was it. I didn't
right.
know who Winnie the Pooh was until
right.
I went to college. But I'd read all the Oz books, and then I came across this literature that was, it seemed aimed right at me, because mm-hmm. it was a story with a
And
really,
it was aimed
it was.
Right at you.
Yeah, I was the guy. I was the guy,
yes.
you know. And they had this really cool idea, and they would develop the idea. And it was they were all thought pieces. I never thought about style. I never thought about being a writer or anything like that. It's kind of odd, now that I think about it. So I didn't come into the field that way. And by the time I was graduating high school, the time I was 17 or 18, I wasn't reading anymore. I was already. I wanted to be Jack Kerouac. The Beats were around. They were in Life magazine, and they were, and that stuff seemed super cool. And that was what, and that's when I decided I wanted to be a writer. And it didn't come from science fiction at all.
But it was working away down there. Layers.
It definitely was. That's a whole other story. But that's not how I saw those. I saw them as thought experiments, which they are.
They are, and they're, you know, they appeal. They, you know, they always say the golden age of science fiction is 13, and I think that that is an age when you're really interested in ideas, exploring ideas, thinking about stuff. And what if we're all really just part? The whole Earth is nothing but a stone on the ring of finger of a giant. You know, all that kind of stuff, and adults aren't interested in talking to you about that stuff, and kids don't get it, And it is, in that sense, I think it is truly an adolescent literature, even though I think it appeals to a lot of adults. But it is that, for that explosion of ideas that hits you at that age, when you suddenly realize that things don't have to be the way they've always been, and that there are all kinds of possibilities are out there. And what if this was all upside down? And what if this was, you know, totally different? And what if women were in charge? And what if this was happening? Well, you know, it was just... It was great to think about all those things.
And to me, I still, the biggest influences on me at that time were Mimsy or the Borogoves.
Oh, I love that story. That's a Kuttner and C.L. Moore story, right?
Yeah, and they made a movie of it, which is totally stupid.
Yes, but the story is chilling. Absolutely chilling.
Yeah,
yes.
And the other one was Surface Tension.
Oh, and I love Surface Tension,
and they
too.
Yeah, through, by and James at Litch, the end, he says, and they looked up and they saw the stars.
Right. Yeah.
Oh, I still get a chill.
I know. It's a great story. It's a wonderful, simply written classic science fiction story, but on another level, it's an allegory. You're like, oh, someone's actually written an allegory. This is great.
Yeah.
And those stories were terrific. And Mimsy were the Borogoves, especially the idea of children as slightly alien and children as something that can slip beyond your control is very...
Yeah.
There have always been a lot of great children's stories in science fiction. You know, stories about like odd children or telepathic children.
That was Zena Henderson. I love those stories.
Oh, and I love Zena Henderson too. Yes.
Well, and it comes in really early because, I mean, you had Stapledon writing Odd John totally in a different, you know, not the pulse in English.
Right.
But again, that just comes in so early.
Yeah, and I don't know if that's because the market is like 13, you know, but the whole, I've never seen that anywhere else as much in literature as in, it's a constantly recurring theme.
Right.
The child as the savior, the child as bringing everything down, like in Zero Hour by Ray Bradbury, the child as other, the child as privy to knowledge that nobody else has. I mean, all those are very flattering to kids.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, it was children's literature in that way, but it was for precocious children.
Right. Precocious children's literature.
Who
that's what it was.
Who didn't
want
to read about talking bunnies
talking
and
pigs
animals.
And, things.
Well, and who also wanted, it's the same drive that goes, well, the other kids pick on me, but it's because I'm special.
Right, exactly.
Not because I'm lame.
That's very true. I think there is that. The other,
well,
especially the Zena Hendersons really appeal to
they
that.
Oh, they
the
did.
The other,
yeah.
The children as other.
The special, yes. And they had to hide it.
Yes, and they had to hide
they
it.
Right.
To
and
hide.
Slan.
And Slan, yes, where everybody's, you're different. And it, of course, that is an adolescent theme because every adolescent feels different.
Yeah. But, you know, I was saying I didn't think of being a writer then, but actually, I did, now that I think about it. I wasn't very serious about it, but I remember reading, and this isn't a short story, but the first time I read Against the Fall of Night, the Arthur, that became City in the Stars,
right,
the first,
right.
And that was just this upswelling of this romantic, sense of wonder,
right,
whatever you call it.
Right.
I still remember the last line, in this universe, night was falling.
Yeah.
Anyways, great stuff.
Yeah, it's
and
chills.
I think at that point, there was a part of me that thought, I'd like to be able to do that. I'd like to be able to do to people what he just did to you.
Right. Exactly.
If I could do that, it would be pretty cool.
Yeah.
And I had somewhat the same feeling with Childhood's End. And the other big influence on me as a novel was City. And at one of the city stores.
Is in this collection, yes. I have this collection that I just bought, a book of Beyond Tomorrow, which is edited by Damon Knight, which is a bunch of short stories from the 1950s, probably. Yeah, mid-50s. And it's got Heinlein's Coventry and a Kate Wilhelm story and an A.E. Van Vogt story and a Bradbury and an Asimov and a Simak and a Henry Kuttner story, which is why I bought it, because I had not read this Henry Kuttner story before. So,
Another big influence on me was Frederick Brown. I love Fred Brown's little short stories.
The Puppet Show, especially.
His name isn't as well known now, but I was really impressed. Charles and Gary have at various times sent me off with lists of things to read and, okay, come back when you've... And I picked up the original CIFWA Hall of Fame volumes and Frederick Brown's Arena.
That's the story where
astronaut just kind of gets teleported to this arena planet, and there's a barrier between him and an alien wizard bad thing.
And he's basically a gladiator.
Yeah, and they're like, okay, now you have to fight. And, and of course, he doesn't just win through brawn, he wins through brains.
Right.
And, but it's very archetypal. And I was like, wow, they wrote that story that far back? We've been retelling that story for decades.
Well, I mean, it's not very far back. At a moment in time.
But you've seen so many, Star Trek episodes and Stargate episodes that are that same premise.
That same story, Well, Frederick Brown, when I went to Spain, I found that he was very, very popular over there. He's like the most revered science fiction writer there is. And he has, and I was able to buy, you know, English translations of all these Fred Brown things that I wasn't able to get in the States. And he was famous for his mysteries, too. He wrote a bunch of mysteries, including a really good one that is based on All the Clues Are from Alice in Wonderland and Through the Looking Glass. It's great. It's
cool.
A terrific book. Huh. And he was one of those, you know, pulp writers who earned a living by writing not only for science fiction, but for all the mystery magazines and Black Mask and Weird Tales and, you know, and Western magazines, anything that, you know, you had to write for all of them to put together a living.
Now, that's when you've got to look at your markets.
Absolutely.
You have to think of it.
Absolutely.
You don't want horses, you don't want guys with six guns.
And, you know, the sad thing is that some people just turn into hacks. I mean, they just pound it out, and it's terrible, and you can't read it. It's all the same. With Fred Brown, he just got better and better. And when I was talking about him one time, we were going over various stories, Arena and Puppet Show and stuff, and then somebody said, oh, you should read this one story. It's a mystery in which you, the reader, are the next victim. And I said, what? How does he do that? That's impossible. How does he do that? And so I then sought out the story. Oh, yes.
How did he do it?
I'm not telling you. You'll have to find it for yourself.
Right.
It's an amazing story. I would not have thought.
Do you remember the title?
I don't. But it's... I bet you could Google Frederick Brown... Reader Murder. And see what came up, because it's a really famous story, and it's just dazzling. And you know everything he wrote, because he had written so much. It's that whole outliers thing. You have to put in 10,000 hours, and then you're competent, and anything you write is going to be good. And he is absolutely the living proof of that, because all of his stuff, whether it's to your taste or not, you know, whether you really like that kind of mysteries or whatever, all of it's good. And you can just read him forever and ever. He's very readable and very fun. So I, of course, prefer his science fiction, but, you know.
Now, didn't he write the story about the atmosphere blowing up, the catching fire? I think there was an astronaut up. That was one of the things.
That is Alfred Bester, Adam and No Eve. He wrote a story like that.
All right. Now, this one's a very short. It was one of the things about science fiction, I think, that appealed to me also was there's stories you could tell. You couldn't tell them as good as they told them, but you could tell them. Here's the story.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Now that's not true for all of them. I mean, you can't tell Theodore Sturgeon's The Man Who Lost the Sea. That is all in the telling. That is all in the structure of the story. But you can't, you're right. You can't, and for many years, you know, I didn't even bother to learn the titles of these things. And I'd say, okay, there's this great story, and here's what happens. And you could tell them, and you would get across the gist. And so many of them, I never remembered any of the characters or anything. What I remembered was this really cool idea about the atmosphere catches fire. Or in Philip Latham's The Zai Effect, they discover that the universe is shrinking and has been shrinking all along and is getting smaller and smaller, and but they didn't notice it until it started getting past the level of the spectrum, you know, because there's a finite size to the spectrum. So actually, we're all just being totally, it's like sort of that room closing in kind of story, only with the planets and the entire universe. I loved that story. It has no characters in it at all. There might be a scientist, maybe, but it's just a pure idea story, and I absolutely loved it.
Well, one other difference between you and me, I think, is, and between me and a lot of people in the field, is I never read Heinlein. I might have read a couple of them, but they didn't appeal to me for some reason, and that wasn't what caught my attention, as with many, was Bradbury. And, and Bradbury, that whole, you know, the sort of, really it's kind of purple.
Yeah, you know, purple, the, it's all style. The stories are all style.
Bradbury was all style. And again, I don't think I wanted to write that. Maybe I did. But anyway, that was what I liked. I loved Bradbury. And my favorite was actually Simak. Simak was a huge favorite of mine. And I would seek out his stuff. I find him hard to read now. Even City, which to me was a revelation, you know. And
why do you think you find him hard to read now?
I think it's real kind of corny and journalistic, and you know, sort of
mid-level. Or the Suck Fairy has been there and sucked out all the goodness.
Yeah, or something. But I wouldn't say that if he was alive listening.
No,
he was a wonderful gentleman, but it was just. It was a little too middle America. I don't know.
It's so funny. Some of the stories you go back, the ones that you just loved, and they don't. I mean, they're not any good. I mean, you're just like, why did I like that? And then others are like, oh my gosh, this is even better than I remember it. Yeah. You know?
By the way, the Fred Brown story of where the reader's next victim, it's titled "Don't Look Behind You."
Okay, don't look behind you. I'll have to remember it this time. But it is a great story. I do recommend it.
But what happened to me was I read all that stuff in, I guess, it was before I got out of high school, and I graduated from high school in 60, so we're talking about the late 50s. And that was really the golden age.
It was the golden age.
We had, and the books were beginning to come out. I remember, City, and Against the Fall of Night and Childhood's End. I hope I'm not wrong about them. I might go back and look at the copyright and be wrong. But I think they were all late 50s.
Sort of in that era.
Yeah. And I feel like I was never part of fandom. I was never thought of myself. I had...
Did you even know about fandom? I didn't know about it.
I had no idea.
Yeah.
And, but the people... there was myself and my best friend in Owensboro, Kentucky. And we would read these stories and talk about them and pass them back and forth. And so I knew a lot of the classic stories, but not all of them. And I feel like I'm somebody who kind of walked down the hall and saw it all and sort of experienced it in a way. But I didn't get as engaged in it as like you're talking about, you know. But it was definitely a huge influence.
So what did you start writing when you were influenced by Kerouac? Were you writing poetry or? Or was it part of your 100,000 words of junk that you have to write?
It was definitely part of that. it was probably, I was writing poetry, which was, you know, that sort of faux beat poetry, which is faux images poetry.
Right.
And I was actually the editor of the little literary magazine in high school, but that was my big dream, and we'd read Evergreen Review. It seemed more grown up. It was the prestige thing. Mm-hmm. That seemed like the place to go and all that kind of stuff. But then the first time I ever actually wrote anything, I was 62 or 3. I was in college in Louisville, and I had a child before I even got out of college, and my wife was pregnant with my son, and I wrote a short story and entered it in the story magazine contest. I've forgotten even what prompted me to do it. But I got an honorable mention and a check for $50. And from, who's the guy that ran Story? Whit Burnett. And that was extremely encouraging. You know? And it was, but it was fantasy. It was not science fiction. It was a very... It was a very literary type fantasy about the kid is born and the kid has wings and the doctor says, oh, you have to cut his wings off so he won't he can fit into society, and they go round and round about it and they decide not to cut his wings off, and sure enough he can fly. I mean, that sounds like the corniest thing in the world, but that
it's
was,
all in the telling.
Yeah, it was, and it wasn't told badly, but that was my first short story. And it was not science fiction at all. It's not the kind of thing I would write. And it was sort of sentimental and sweet. And then the stuff I worked on after that was I wrote a novel because I wanted to write. And it was, what do they call it? The typical young man's novel. It could have been Bright Lights, Big City. It could have been
right.
On the Road. It was,
yeah.
You know. And it never sold. And I, so... That was the first thing I tried to write. And then I didn't really try to write anything after that for probably 10 years.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I published my first science fiction novel when I was right at 40. I was 37 or 38 years old. And that was because of Hartwell.
Uh-huh.
And he said, but anyway, that's a whole other story. It's not short stories. And then got into short stories through... through Ella, and then...
Well, wait, how'd you come to meet Hartwell and Datlow?
I worked in publishing.
Okay.
And I went to New York because I had...
You had to have read Youngblood Hawk or something. You're following the total Youngblood Hawk pattern here.
It's a very familiar pattern. It's a very familiar pattern. Now, what happened was I wrote this novel... when I was living in Louisville, I had two kids, and I graduated from college. I was a social worker, but I still wanted to be...
part of the literary world.
Right. I wanted to be part of the literary world. And so I wrote this novel, and I sent it to New York, and an agent really liked it. And she said she would like to take me on, you know. Well, the agent was Dorothy Olding. She was Salinger's agent. She had been Fitzgerald's agent. And I knew that. Yeah, And
wow.
I thought, you know, this is it. And so I ended up going to New York, and it never sold. And it was, and I don't even know where it is now. It's kind of gone. I haven't seen it in years. But what happened was I started working in comics, and I worked for tabloid magazines, softcore porn, astrology magazines. You know, I was sort of a hack writer and all
right.
this stuff, which
right.
was fun. It was
right.
great. And so I did that for many years, and then I ended up with at Berkeley, and I was a copywriter, and I wrote all the cover copy. And that was when Berkeley was... And Hartwell was the guy, and they were bringing back all these the Poul Anderson and stuff, and putting it out. I wrote the cover copy on all these books, and Hartwell, and I was doing Michael Moorcock, all of his stuff. And Hartwell said, "You've got the sound. There's that sort of faux Elizabethan high sound that you get, you know." And he says, "You've got that." He says, "Give me an outline." And I can give you $1,500, and you can write me a novel. And basically, I said, "Get thee behind me, Satan," because I did not want to be a hack writer that wrote something to order like that. And he asked me two or three times, and finally, I did it, and and wrote a sort of a Moorcock imitation, which is still around. I signed one downstairs, you know. And it wasn't terrible, but it was okay.
Yeah.
And what that did to me, it said, you don't have to be James Joyce. You don't have to, because I had a very high-minded idea of who I wanted to be. It was total bullshit. But doing this novel, all of a sudden I realized, well, I can do this. And so anyway, that's how I got into
wow.
it. Wow. And it was a great thing. It broke a 10-year writer's block.
That's
for me.
That's good. Yeah. You don't want to be James Joyce anyway.
No, not now, but then I did. I never wanted to be James Joyce. I wanted to be Jack Kerouac.
Yeah.
Or
you don't want to be Jack Kerouac either. You want to be one of the finest short story writers in science fiction. That's a pretty good thing to be.
Yeah, no, I'm not complaining. But that's how I got into it. But I was talking with my friend Paul Park and Christopher Rowe last night, and they both just finished writing these stupid Dungeons and Dragons novels. And the both of them, I said the same thing. You guys, that's a good thing. You should do it. You should do it. And it'll, you know. And to me, it was... and then Hartwell said, well, that book did okay. You can write anything you want. And I wrote... But it turned out to be a fantasy. So it turned out that science fiction fantasy was really... what I wanted to write. So you're right about being a deep current. I never did the other kind of stuff.
Well, and I think it's so interesting to hear people's stories about what they wrote besides science fiction, you know, because, Silverberg wrote porn and Cynthia Felice wrote porn. And my thing was that I always aimed for science fiction, unlike you. Science fiction is where I wanted to be from the day I read Have Space, It Will Travel.
That's cool.
I never changed that, ever. And people are always saying, so when are you going to write something, you know, that can be marketed out in the real world? And I'm like, you know, why? I got exactly where I wanted. Why would I go anywhere else? I don't understand the question. But of course, I couldn't make a living at that. I was home with a baby. And trying to write short stories, and I was sending them out, and they weren't nothing was selling. That was part of my 100,000 words of garbage that I was writing, and but I was able to sell some confession stories, like for True Confessions, True Romance, and those are sort of you know blue collar soap operas kind of stories.
I worked at True Romance.
Sin,
that was one
sex,
of my jobs.
And repent. Really, maybe you bought one of my stories. It's possible. And those I could write competently enough that I could sell them. And then I had money.
Cool.
Then I had money coming in, which kept me from having to get a full-time writing job.
80 or 100 bucks
job.
A story.
Right. Yeah. Well, no, actually, I think I was making about 250.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh,
so that wasn't too bad. And I always liked those stories because my grandmother had always read those magazines. So I understood the stories and I knew what they wanted, and it was a true case of knowing the market. But I started fiddling around because you can't, and they're a really good place, I think, to do an apprenticeship. I think a lot of the hack stuff is a good place to do an apprenticeship because you're learning how to write sentences and paragraphs and dialogue and scenes and how to cut things down and all that stuff. But in the confessions, I couldn't. Obviously, no fantasy elements or science fiction elements. I couldn't set things in Paris or Venice, you know, because it was supposed to be, you know, Milwaukee kind of stories. And I couldn't do anything elaborate with the stories because they were supposed to be very uneducated people. So no literary allusions, nothing like that. So there was nothing left to do except plot. And I just plotted my little brains out, you know, and that was why I got so fascinated with all the possibilities of what you can do with plot, which people is like a poor stepchild. It's something people go, well, you know, this novel is sort of plot heavy, and it doesn't, you know, and you're like, no, plot can do all the work that you normally do with description or that you do with characters. And so I was in love with that, and then I found that I could write what I wanted to write. So I did a couple of romantic comedies, they were confession stories, but instead of having the usual sin, sex, repent, they had a romantic comedy plot. And
you got away with it.
And I got away with it because I had enough of the element. One was called I Called for Help on My CB and Got a Rapist Instead. Now, the rapist was not the hero of this romantic comedy. The hero was the guy who rescued her from the rapist. But they were, it was about a girl who, she was constantly struggling against her brother's overprotectiveness and managed to struggle enough that she got herself in a situation where there was a rapist. So, but she dealt with it, and the boyfriend dealt with it, and it all worked out. And so I was having really a good time with that. But I mean, your name isn't on those. I mean, they're the purest form of hack work. Because
they're first person.
They're true.
They're true.
So, my God, how can they have an author's name on them? So they were, and there is no year's best collection of confession stories, although perhaps there should be. But much as I enjoyed them, I was still the whole time trying to break into science fiction. Eventually, I did. But
that's great.
After writing a whole bunch of stories that weren't any good at all and which will never see the light of day, thank God, you know.
But you wrote some pretty good romance stories.
I wrote some pretty good romances. Yeah. And one of the first science fiction stories I wrote, in fact, the first one, I think, I wrote The Secret of Santa Titicaca, which is a story that was part of that 100,000 words but accidentally got published by Gardner. And so it's out there, and I'm so ashamed. I'm so ashamed. But the first real story when I started publishing regularly for Galileo was a romantic comedy, and in fact was called Capra Corn. And yeah, I was in my pun stage at that point, and I'm sorry. I'd like to apologize to the whole world for my pun stage. I'm over it now. But you know, it was a classic romantic comedy. This alien had come. He was clearly there to romance the heroine, and she was not romanceable. And he battled against that the entire time and finally won her over. And so I guess that was real early strain in my career. And then I wrote lots of really grim stories and got more famous for my grim stories early on. And that's what I started winning awards for. And then people were really surprised when I was doing comedy. So there was a theory. It was really interesting for a while that floating around the net that there were two Connie Willises. There was the one that wrote the grim stuff and the one that wrote the comedies. I'm like, that's so ridiculous. What a ridiculous idea is that?
I don't know. It works for me. That's a good theory.
But I'm like, you know, these stories aren't that different. To me, and to me, one of the things I always loved about Shakespeare is that he'll take the material and he'll do a comedy with it. And then he'll take the exact same material and do a tragedy with it. And it's like he proves that it's all in the handling and all in the attitude. It has nothing, you know, there is no... A story in itself is not tragic or comic. It's all in how you do it.
Right, entirely, you know? Entirely. So what led you into novels?
Well, I sort of stumbled into that backwards because I had written a novella called Lincoln's Dreams. And then when I took it to my workshop, I was in a workshop forever. And 17 years, I believe, I was in a workshop. And everybody had criticisms, and the criticisms were all, I don't understand this, I don't understand that. You need to expand this more. I'm not getting this. I don't see quite this connection that you're making. And there was nowhere to go but longer.
Ah, okay.
So I was almost there anyway. But you can't take a novella, add some words, and it's a novel. It's structured totally differently.
Not a long short story.
Right.
Yeah.
It's structured totally differently. Although some people think that Lincoln's Dreams is a long short story in that it has far fewer characters and a much more linear plot than most novels do. But I kind of took it apart and then totally changed the structure so that it was a novel. And that was my first novel. And then that was...
It did well.
And I was happy with that. I was happy because I told the story I really wanted to tell. And so then I was more willing to do novels. But I still was writing. I mean, I wrote Firewatch after that.
There in the background, there's the thing in if you're working for Gardner or for Hartwell... They always say you have to write a novel.
Right.
You can't just do it unless you're Harlan Ellison.
They're absolutely right. I mean, there are a few exceptions that prove the rule that you can have. But for the most part, you can't have a career based totally on short stories.
No, not these days. Not in those days.
Not in those days. No. I mean, you could, if you were willing to keep your day job and have this be a sideline, then you could. But otherwise, you needed to do a novel. So
that still seems mostly true.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it is. And my objection right now, my pet peeve is that, you know, I run into beginning writers all the time, and they're not just writing a novel, which I think most of them would do better with short stories, not because short stories aren't just as hard to write, but because if you're in your learning curve and you are writing a novel, you are the writer you are at the beginning of that novel and at the end are two different writers, and it's going to be really obvious that, you know, you were learning as you went. So short stories, not so much. You know, you can do a short story in a close enough period that it's one period of your life. But now everybody's not writing novels. They're writing these trilogies and quadrologies and tetralogies. And I'm like, that's terrible. You're committing to a huge, long project before you even know who you are or how to write. And I wish people would go back to the short story.
Well, that's interesting. I never thought of it like that. But, yeah. To me, I did a couple of novels, and I've done five or six. And I'm proud of them. But they're not runaway successes. And to me, the process of writing a novel was...
awful.
I would always get a third or half, maybe even halfway through a novel, and realize that I didn't really know what I was doing, and I had to. I think when Gene Wolfe had said one time, he says, "You never learn how to write novels; you just learn how to write the novel you're writing."
Right. That's true.
I think it's not true for everybody. I think, like for example, Stan Robinson is good at writing novels. He doesn't. You know, he doesn't thrash around the way I thrash
around. I thrash around all the time.
And there are some people who it comes... I'm not a natural storyteller. I don't think I'm ever... I don't tell stories so much. And so... or that's the way I look at it. And so they're difficult for me. But I've... and the other thing, in a short story, it's kind of all in RAM. And you can kind of...
Right. You can hold the whole thing in your head at the same time, right?
Yeah, and I used to be an auto mechanic, and I loved the intellectual challenge of the problem solving that goes into working on cars. And that, to me, is what a short story is like. But a novel is like farming. It's like every day you go out the same goddamn field.
That's right.
It looks pretty much the same today as it looked
yesterday.
You know?
Yes.
And so it's like this long process. And some people are really good at that, and I'm not particularly good at it. And I'm still not. I just finished a novel, and it took me three years.
I have a question. I assume that if you got stuck in the middle, then that you didn't have the whole thing plotted out before you started.
I never plotted it out.
Yeah.
And because I'm... I don't...
Because that's not how you work. I know. I always plot everything out, and so I do all my thrashing around in that stage.
Well, that's the great experience from True Romance. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
That never happened to me.
Yeah, and I thrash around like crazy for about a year and a half to 2 years until I have the whole plot ready. And then I can start writing the book. And in between, I've written... If I've like in my UFO novel, I thought of one scene that I know how to do, and I just did it, you know. And I'll have to change it probably when I get to it. But in the meantime, I knew how to write that scene, and I don't care where it comes in the book. I know how to write it.
Yeah.
And so I write it out of order, and I write it, you know, sometimes back to front, and sometimes front to back, and sometimes all over the place. But the whole time, I know where I'm going because I have this plot. Because my plots are always mystery plots. And because they are, I can't plant my clues if I don't know where I'm going and what the solution is.
Well, I don't know if that's knowing how to write a novel, but that comes pretty close to me.
You wouldn't think if you saw me thrashing around. You would say, oh my gosh, she has no idea what she's doing.
Yeah. I think my basic idea, some of my novels work, but the fundamental way I go at it is if I've got a couple of characters and a neat idea, I can throw in enough stuff to make it seem like there's a story,
right.
You know?
Yeah, exactly.
And sometimes a story will kind of appear, but I don't ever... I don't do it very scientifically.
I have a question for you. Okay, my question is, which of your stories do you feel the story on the page is the closest to the story you had in your head? Like, I wouldn't say your favorite story, because favorites have lots of reasons, but the one where you felt like you really got onto the paper what you were trying to do.
I'd have to think about that. I don't think I ever had that clear an idea of... I don't know.
Of what you want.
Yeah. No, that would slow us down.
So you're a much more organic writer.
Well,
I think
that's a way of making it seem like a virtue. Organic is a good word.
That was intentional. That's right.
You might say I'm more of a synthetic, right? I don't know. But yeah, whatever it is. Yeah.
I mean, everybody does it. It's so amazing. Well, you know, we'll have these panels and five writers, and they're all really good writers, you know, but you're just appalled by the methods that the others use. You're like, I could no more write a book that way than The Man in the Moon. And it's really fascinating. Joe Haldeman, that's the one I don't get at all. He like writes the first sentence of the book, and then he works on it until it's perfect. And then he moves on to the second sentence. And sometimes it takes him a week to write the sentence, but he never changes it once he's written. I'm like, what? 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 And yet his books are great.
What was that story he did, the Hemingway hoax?
Oh, yes.
You know, I taught a science fiction writing class, I did it in New York. And one of the things I would do in the class is take first lines or first few lines and say, how much information is here? And one of the things I always used was the beginning of Joe's The Hemingway Hoax, because everything, it's all in there, the whole thing.
Yeah, that's because he worked on that first sentence for a month.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, that's one of them that, some people are like that.
Yeah, well, and the interesting thing is, I don't think you can tell from the finished product what the work method was. I mean, on that same panel, Nancy Kress, she's more like you. She would get an idea and then she'd sort of charge out, because that's what she finds interesting, is making up the story as she goes. Well, you know, they're both great novelists. They both do terrific stuff. It's just very different. And I think that's what's so frustrating about trying to teach writing, is that the students always think that there's a method and that you're going to teach them the method. And the truth is, you can only say, well, this is what this writer does, and this is what this writer does, and this is what I do, but that may not work for you, and if it doesn't, you got to think of something else. Yeah. So,
no, I never taught method. When I taught, it was always just what you had to have. You have to have a timeline.
Right.
You have to have, you know. My approach was, and I still believe this, that the short story is the it's the controlled release of information.
Right. Absolutely.
You know, and so you have to, the point of your first beginning is you're letting the reader know. You're releasing a little bit of information, but part of the information you're releasing is that I'm in control of this information.
Exactly.
So you better pay attention.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, And
I'm going to raise more questions than I give you information, because I want you to keep reading.
Right.
And you don't keep reading because of the information I tell you. You keep reading because of the questions I have not answered yet.
Yeah.
I think that's a big mistake beginning writers make, is they tend to give you a whole bunch of information up front. And the truth is that, you know, like the beginning line of I Capture the Castle is, I am writing this sitting in the kitchen sink. And you're like, that's maybe the best first sentence ever.
Right.
Because
What the heck are you doing?
And it takes you quite a while to figure out, and it all makes perfect sense later, but it's just, wonderful.
You know where it's set in time.
You do.
You know that it's a woman.
Yes, you do.
For some reason.
You do know.
Because somehow a guy's not sitting in
the sink. That's right. Why is it a woman? Right.
And you know that it has,
And it's something people don't usually do.
Right, yeah.
So why is she there? And you could have about a million stories that come from that. From that, including science fiction stories.
Yeah.
But it is just, you know, it intrigues the reader. And I, one thing I always do, I'm such a control freak, that I will make lists of, okay, like in a story like Letter from the Clearys, which was basically the structure there is an onion story. You're making people think that the situation is this, and then you're giving them another piece of information, and they realize that, oh, the situation is actually this. And then you give them another, oh, it's actually this. And then all the way to the very end and the very last line where you do the final surprise. I learned that from Ward Moore, whose lot is structured exactly that way. So I didn't learn it like, oh, Ward Moore told me this, or this story told me this. It was more like I just wrote what I read. And then when I looked back at it, I realized that was the structure. It's the structure of Sophie's Choice, you know, and lots of stories. And so then I had to, but I started writing this story and just randomly writing it. And then I thought, this isn't, because it's about a girl who's walking home from the post office with her dog, and it seems like a typical rural kind of story. And then you realize it's after the bomb. and then you realize other things all the way through. And I realized that I was not in control of the information at all. And I had no idea which secret I should give away first, second, and third. So I just sat down and wrote a list. Here's what I want them to find out first, second, third, fourth, and fifth. And here's why they need to be in this order. And that took me, just months to just come up with that list. And once I had the list, I wrote the story in like a week and a half.
Well, that's
because then I knew how to do it. But before, I was just sort of randomly doing stuff. And I did the same thing with Lincoln's Dreams. When I got through with it, I realized the whole middle was a mess. And then thought, the reason is that I'm releasing information randomly, and I need to release it so that each step brings you closer to the solution of the mystery. So what order do these need to be in? And it all sounds so cold-hearted, I guess would be the word, as opposed to organic.
Yeah.
Very cold-hearted way of doing it. But it's just, to me, the most effective way for me to work. And it's not that I don't love my characters and care about my story, but for me to make you love my characters and care about my story, I've got to do this very technical, cold-hearted stuff.
Absolutely. I agree. And I used to make fun of people that, you know, these things release your inner writer and, you know, it's all
garbage.
I
think it's total garbage.
I mean, a story is a contrivance. You know?
It's
a contrivance.
It's an artificial construct.
Right, yeah.
And you can't just release it. It'll be a pile of goo if you do that.
And I always laugh at people. They say, my character's I just create them and
right.
They
walk away and do what they
and
want.
And they do their own thing. But in fact, if I really look at it coldly, that's actually what I do. You know,
I think though that what you do is, what you're really saying is, I realized that the character I had created wouldn't act the way I decided wanted them to act.
Yeah.
Or the character I decided I needed for this story would not act that way. So really, I'm still in control. I mean, I have said sometimes to people, my characters do what I tell them, including die. If I say die, they die.
No, I say the same thing, but I think it's more true of you than me, because my characters, I put them in there to look around and stuff, but I don't really know what they're going to do.
Right.
You know,
right.
I should. I think I should, but
no,
I don't.
So, I mean, I think when I talk to people like you, that what's really going on is that's the part I do all in my head. That's the noodling around part I do before I ever start writing.
Yeah.
I think a lot of writers, though, start the writing process and then do it after that. And it's not that it's a different kind of way to do it. It's just the timing is different. You know?
But I think the only thing you can't actually teach is you do have to have a timeline.
You have to have a timeline.
And you have to be in control of your timeline.
Yes, you do.
You know. And
control of your information.
Yeah, and all that kind of stuff. And that I think you can teach.
Right.
And the rest, who knows. But certainly the process you can't teach. I did that a little bit because I was teaching this class in New York. I took it over from Charles Platt, who took it over from Shauna McCarthy.
Oh,
it was this traditional thing at the New School. It had been there for years.
Uh-huh.
Shauna had done it for like 5 years, and then Charles did it. Charles gave it to me. I gave it to Alice Turner when I left New York. And they never folded it into the MFA program. It's like we were...
stood separate.
we were not part of the...
Yeah.
But my whole approach was people would come in, and the last thing I wanted... And the people that come to this were not college students. They were in their middle 30s. They had a job. They'd always wanted to write. They kind of liked... Everybody,
right.
Of course. Oh, you're a science fiction writer. I used to love science fiction.
Yes, I know.
So,
the worst thing anyone can say to you.
The last thing I wanted was somebody bringing in their novel or
something
like that. So I would say, in this class, we're going to write what I tell you. And basically, everybody bring in three ideas that you think that if you dramatized them would make an interesting story. And then the class together, we would discuss them and pick one for everybody.
Like that. Oh,
and then what
good.
They had to do was dramatize that idea.
And they had to start from scratch instead of their old trunk story, which is really good.
Start from scratch, and it doesn't matter if it's a great story or not, because whatever, I want you to dramatize this. So you have to have characters and dialogue and all that kind of stuff. And I also don't think you're really teaching people to write. Very few of them were good writers, but they learn how to read better. And they enjoyed it. It was fun. They learned how, you know, so you can
teach.
How to
understand what's in stories, right?
Yeah, you understand
more
about it.
But I think you're right. I don't think you can teach what the story should be about. What I have found is that I teach Clarion West sometimes, and that the story is somewhere out here, and the person is here, you know, and there's a huge distance between them. And that, you know, I'm always saying, you know, even if this is set on Mars, this story needs to be about you. It needs to be about something that enrages you, something that humiliated you, something that makes you feel something really strong, because otherwise there is no story, you know, and you've got to have, you know, there's got to be some connection with you. And they'd say things like, well, this is my vampire story, and this is my, I'm like, you can't have a vampire story. You have to have, why are you writing this vampire story? What is the connection to you? What is it about vampires that makes you want to write about them? And I think there is that emotional disconnect for a lot of beginning writers that don't, and I did that myself when I was, you know, just starting out, because I was basically just copying what I read, you know.
Right.
But very early, I realized, I wrote a story like second or third outing, and it was not even a science fiction story. It was for a teen magazine. And I picked a thing that had, a humiliating experience that had happened to me in high school. And it was very personal. And I only fictionalized it slightly in the story. And the response to that story was like huge, and I thought, I think I'm onto something here. I think this is the way to really make the stories work, is if it's really, you're vividly remembering that driving emotion, and it's coming from you, not from, I'm going to write a story about this, you know, that's way out here. And I think the best writers know that instinctively.
Well, maybe,
or teach themselves somehow or something. But I think that's the part that seems so often missing in beginning writers, is that they haven't made that, or maybe they're afraid to make that connection. It's awfully, it's hard to write a story about your most humiliating experience in life. That's
I do hate to interrupt there, but I'm getting to the point where I would hate to keep you guys from dinner, because I know you especially have evening programming.
Well, we both do.
Yes, we both do. And I have a dinner I'm going to at 6. So.
Right. So.
Well, we didn't have any trouble talking for an hour, did we?
I told you. Well, do you want us to say something about Locus a little bit?
Well, actually, the traditional closing is, what do you guys have out right now that you'd like people to know about? Of course, you've got Blackout/All Queer.
Blackout/All Queer, which is actually one book,
two volumes.
Don't read All Queer first. Don't read Blackout last. Please read them in order together.
Right.
So, yes.
And Terry, you've got a novel coming?
I have a short story book called TVA Baby that just came out from PM, and I have a novel called Any Day Now that will come out from Outlook Press in probably a year and a half. So that's.
And we love Locus. I always tell my students, the first thing I tell them at Clarion West is, you have to subscribe to Locus. You cannot call yourself a writer unless you are subscribed to
Locus. Oh, you mean
Locus
the magazine? I thought you were talking about the bugs.
Locus.
Locus. Oh, I've seen it. The magazine about wizards and dragons and stuff. I've seen people reading it.
Locus.
If you read it on the airplane, nobody will talk to you.
No, that's true. I'm sure that's true.
Yeah, it's like reading the Bible. It keeps it.
That's true. Maybe you should change the name of Locus to Locus.
And we can raise that with Liza some other day.
Okay.
Awesome. So. But thank you both so much.
Cool. It was fun.